Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Speaking in Hanover, Germany Monday, President Obama ordered an increase in the number of U.S. Special Operations Forces in Syria by up to 250 additional troops to increase the pressure on Islamic State. The U.S. earlier deployed some 50 U.S. troops. Mr. Obama spoke about the decision on the CBS television network.
Dismantling ISIL is a priority, although we are not going to be sending ground troops in to fight. We are going to try to find out what works and then double down. And one of the things that's worked so far is us putting special forces in for training and advising of local forces, but also intelligence gathering.
Peter Cook, a U.S. Defense Department spokesman, said the reinforcements will add to what the previous 50 have already done in the fight against the IS group.
They'll be establishing connections with forces on the ground, capable forces to take the fight to ISIL. They'll be improving our picture of the battlefield, our sense of what's happening on the ground. So they'll be engaging with forces on the ground, getting a better picture of the battle space, improving our intelligence assessment and our targeting assessment as well.
Earlier this month, the U.S. announced the deployment of additional 200 troops and attack helicopters in Iraq, where they hope to retake captured IS territory. Dozens of South Sudanese rebels led by Commander Simon Gatwich Duel arrived Monday in the capital Juba in a tangible sign of movement toward fulfilling last year's peace agreement and unity government. But there's no indication when rebel leader Riek Machar will arrive. Machar supposedly will become vice president in a power-sharing deal which reached with President Salva Kiir in regional talks in Ethiopia last year. The U.S. has blamed both sides for holding up implementation of the peace agreement. This is VOA News. Tuesday marks the 30th anniversary of the Chernobyl nuclear disaster when an explosion at the power plant near the Ukrainian town contaminated a wide area and sent radiation clouds across the world. At least 31 died immediately, but an estimated thousands more have succumbed to cancer and other illnesses in the ensuing decades. Former plant employee Ludmila Kamkina said at the time she didn't think this catastrophe would change lives forever. She described it as a silent nuclear war. The site is still to be decommissioned. Some 40 nations have contributed billions for a long-term shelter over the building that contains the destroyed reactor, replace a temporary sarcophagus, which is a lifespan of some 30 years. A car bomb exploded in a predominantly Shia commercial district in eastern Baghdad Monday, killing at least 11 civilians, wounding nearly 40 others. There is no immediate claim of responsibility, but Islamic State frequently targets commercial areas and Shia-majority districts. Police in Kenya used tear gas to prevent opposition demonstrators led by former Prime Minister Raila Odinga from storming offices of the country's Electoral Commission, demanding its dissolution ahead of next year's election. Several arrests were made. The opposition accuses the commission of failing to act on their complaints of incompetence and irregularities in how the last election, won by President Uhuru Kenyatta, was concluded. In Egypt Monday, police used tear gas to break up anti-government protests. The latest demonstrations follow the decision by the government of President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi to return two islands in the Red Sea to Saudi Arabia. The latest protests, they're the largest protests since the former armed forces chief took power 2 years ago. The islands, originally controlled by Saudi Arabia, were under Egyptian control at Riyadh's request since 1950. South Africa's ruling African National Congress said Monday it will sue opposition politician Julius Malema after he allegedly threatened to remove President Jacob Zuma by force. Malema, head of the Economic Freedom Fighters, was interviewed Sunday by Al Jazeera. He said if the government uses violence to suppress protests, quote, we will remove this government through the barrel of a gun. The EEF and Democratic Alliance are expected to make gains in local elections scheduled in August. In U.S. presidential politics, voters in five states will go to the polls Tuesday to choose more delegates pledged to candidates seeking the White House on both the Republican and Democratic sides. In contests, delegates at stake will include Pennsylvania, Delaware, Rhode Island, Connecticut, and Maryland. New York businessman Donald Trump looking to burnish his front-runner status in the Republican contest. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton continues to lead Vermont Socialist Senator Bernie Sanders by a wide margin. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The ICC opens preliminary investigation into Burundi killings.
My office has reviewed communications and reports about killings, imprisonment, torture, rape, and other forms of sexual violence, as well as cases of enforced disappearances.
Fatou Bensouda is prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. South Sudan rebel military commander returns to Juba, but no word yet when rebel leader Riek Machar will return. And today is the anniversary of the Union of Tanganyika in Zanzibar, but the opposition says the union is not well.
Cancelling the celebration doesn't make any sense at the end of the day, because in the first place, the opposition decided to boycott these celebrations. But two, we have a serious primary crisis to take care of in Zanzibar. Who has formed the government? Why have they formed the government?
Frema Umboy is the national chairman of the opposition Chadema Party of mainland Tanzania. Cameroon aims to block trafficking of women to the Middle East. Disabled people in Zimbabwe want accessibility to schools and other public places, and researchers help elephants buzz off Kenyan farms. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The International Criminal Court says it is opening a preliminary investigation into the violence that erupted last year in Burundi. Meanwhile, a military general and an advisor to Burundi's vice president was shot dead Monday, along with his wife and a bodyguard. From Paris, Lisa Bryan has more for VOA on what the ICC probe means.
International Criminal Court prosecutor Fatou Bensouda says this preliminary probe is not an investigation and offered no timeline of how long it will last. But in a statement announcing her decision Monday, she says she's been closely tracking the uptick of violence in the Central African nation that's been a member of the Hague-based court since 2004.
My office has reviewed communications and reports about killings, imprisonment, torture, rape, and other forms of sexual violence, as well as cases of enforced disappearances. Because all these acts appear to fall within the jurisdiction of the ICC, I have decided to open a preliminary examination into the situation in Burundi since April of 2015.
Burundi's political crisis was triggered last year when President Pierre Nkurunziza ran for a third term. Bensouda says at least 430 people have been killed, 3,400 have been arrested, and more than 230,000 Burundians have fled the country. On Monday, a high-ranking general and his wife were reportedly killed, dropping their daughter off at school. Human Rights Watch International Justice Advocacy Director Gerardine Mattioli-Zeltner welcomed the ICC's announcement, but said it is only a first step.
We hope this announcement by the ICC that it's opening a preliminary examination in Burundi is really a wake-up call to all those who commit these crimes or order these crimes to be committed, that there will not be impunity anymore for grave human rights violations.
The United Nations last week accused Burundi's security services of torturing and illegally detaining several hundred people this year. Last month, the European Union suspended aid to the Burundian government over the political crisis. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The chief of general staff of South Sudan's rebels returned to Juba yesterday, Monday, along with about 200 military personnel. General Simon Gatwich Duwal had been expected to arrive last week, but his charter plane was not granted landing permission by the South Sudan government. As Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba, there are hopes that Duwal's arrival would soon lead to the much-anticipated return of rebel leader Riek Machar.
Yeah. Lieutenant General Simon Gatwich chants a victory slogan upon landing in Juba. Dressed in a green military uniform, Gatwich disembarked the chartered plane with 195 military officers. Accompanying the soldiers was 20 rocket-propelled grenades and 20 machine guns, something the government and SPLM-IO agreed to after arguing over how many and what kind of weapons Machar's troops could bring to Juba. Speaking in Arabic at the airport, the SPLM-IO's top commander's message was brief and to the point.
I salute the officers and non-commissioned officers and the citizens of liberated South Sudan. I arrived today, the 25th, at 3 p.m. in the capital of South Sudan. South Sudan is one. The people of South Sudan are one. The president of South Sudan is one. Peace be upon you.
No government officials made public remarks upon Gatwich's arrival. General Marial Chenoang, commander of President Salva Kiir's Presidential Guards, known as Tiger Forces, two other senior army officers and two lawmakers received Gatwich inside the airport's VIP lounge. Machar did not travel with his top commander today, despite confirmation from both sides last week that the government had provided all necessary clearances for Machar to land in Juba. Information Minister Michael Makwei told South Sudan in Focus that, despite the many delays, the government will continue to make assurances that Machar can safely return to Juba. Makwei says the government is ready to cover Machar's transportation costs to Juba after the U.S. and the other two Troika countries notified both sides that they would no longer provide chartered jets for Machar and his top commanders to arrive in Juba.
The peace belongs to us. It doesn't belong to anybody. And if this position is communicated to the government officially, then the government will act otherwise.
Makwei says that so far his office has not received any request from the SPLM-IO regarding Machar's return to Juba. Last week, Machar's officials said the former rebel leader would only return to Juba if his chief of staff and weapons were transported to Juba. Makwei advised South Sudanese to remain hopeful. The South Sudan government says once Machar returns to Juba, he will be sworn in as the country's first vice president and join President Kiir in forming the transitional government of national unity as stipulated in the August peace deal. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wodo in Juba.
Today, Tuesday, is Union Day in Tanzania, a day in 1964 on which Tanganyika merged with the island of Zanzibar to form Tanzania. But reform-minded President John Magufuli has cancelled this year's Union Day celebrations as a cost-saving measure. Instead, the president has recommended that the money for the celebrations be used for road construction. Frema Mbowe, national chairman of the opposition Chadema Party, says the state of the union is not well because tensions remain high following last October's presidential election in Zanzibar, which the opposition believes it won. Mbowe said cancelling the Union Day celebration is a mockery of how best to deal with the political situation in Zanzibar.
In this year's celebration, the main opposition party in Zanzibar, that TUF, will not participate in any way whatsoever in celebrating the union celebrations. And also the main opposition party in the mainland, that is our party, Chadema, will also not participate in any way in celebrating the union celebration. So that being the case, there's still a turmoil in Zanzibar. Zanzibar is still under military occupation. The Union Armed Forces are in all streets in Zanzibar. And consequently, this Union celebration is taking place when the situation in Zanzibar is extremely very tense.
Ms. Mbowe, as you know, President Magufuli has cancelled the Union celebration. What do you make of that?
Cancelling the Union celebration, to me, is really a mockery of dealing with the problem in Zanzibar. We have a problem that needs to be taken care of in Zanzibar. The party that won the election in Zanzibar has to be recognized. Cancelling the celebration doesn't make any sense at the end of the day because, in the first place, the opposition decided to boycott these celebrations. But two, we have a serious primary crisis to take care of. And the primary crisis that has to be taken care of is, what about the government in Zanzibar? Who has formed the government? Why have they formed the government? Are we really in acceptance to what happened in Zanzibar? Certainly not.
I was reading an opinion piece from the Tanzanian papers, the Tanzania Editors Forum. They are saying that they want wider television coverage of parliament. What is your view as an opposition member?
As the leader of the opposition in the Union Parliament, we observe with great concern the strategic kind of decision by the government of Tanzania to actually censor the freedom of information in the country. The government has denied the freedom of the media, but denying all the media houses, television, radio stations, etc., to actually beam and air the live coverage of the parliament. This has been a great concern to most people out here. So the Media Council is challenging this. The opposition bloc is also challenging this.
The way we understand it is that President Magufuli decided to cancel this live coverage of parliamentary proceedings as a cost-saving measure.
This is a mockery to the whole thing, really. We know the government is in control of the TBC, that is Tanzania Broadcasting Corporation. But again, the private media decided and volunteered to air the live coverage of the parliament. But now they're denying all the private media to air the proceedings in the government. So the question of cost-cutting exercise is just a mere excuse, really, to try and hide their face on protecting the general public in knowing what is exactly going on in the parliament.
Frimo Umboy is national chairman of the opposition Chadema Party of mainland Tanzania. He was speaking with me from the capital, Dar es Salaam. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, April 26. Daybreak Africa time is 16 minutes past the hour. Cameroon's government says it is working to stop the trafficking of young women to the Middle East. The government says hundreds of women and girls have been lured to Kuwait, the United Arab Emirates, and other countries in the past 5 years. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the capital, Yaoundé.
Several students stand at the entrance to the University of Yaoundé. They read posters advertising jobs in Kuwait, Qatar, Lebanon and the United Arab Emirates. The ads promise monthly salaries of up to $700.
If I work for a year, I will be able to save 3.6 million francs, so I am ready to sacrifice 5 years before I return to create a business back here. Why should I continue with my studies when thousands of others graduate and are never recruited?
VOA called the number listed on the poster offering jobs of sales agents, nurses, and teachers.
Everybody who comes will never be paid because the opportunities are good.
The man declined to give his name. VOA went to the address he indicated but was told the company had moved. Police said the phone number belongs to a Cameroonian under investigation as a middleman for traffickers. Many of the women go to Kuwait, like 30-year-old Pauline Manyi. She says her father had died and she was looking for a better life, an adventure. She says she was told Arabs needed translators from the English to the French and vice versa. Instead, she says her passport was taken and she was sold to a family where she was raped and forced to do housework. Another woman, 24-year-old Keba Mukeria, just returned to Cameroon in April. She says her family had borrowed money to send her to Kuwait to work, but she was sold to a man at the airport when she arrived.
I had no rest, king all round the clock. I finished work around 3 o'clock in the night and then no food. Then in the next morning, they came and woke me up at 6 o'clock. They said, Yela, get up, start your work. The only thing they give to eat there is one kubus, one of their bread, and then give you a small cup of tea. That's it for the whole day.
Cameroonian airport authorities now screen women and girls heading to the Middle East. Francisca Awa is president of the Association Against Human Trafficking.
Since they have blocked the girls from going to Kuwait from all international airports in Cameroon, they pass through Nigeria and go to Kuwait.
Awa and other survivors give talks at schools and universities warning of the dangers of trafficking. Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
People with disabilities say commemorating 36 of independence in Zimbabwe from colonial rule should also be a time for Zimbabweans to reflect on the numerous challenges that the disabled face. Safari Unjema of VOA Zimbabwe program reports from Harare.
Programs officer of the National Association of Societies for the Care of the Handicapped, Tsarai Mungoni, says while Zimbabweans were liberated politically, many still have negative attitudes towards people with disabilities. He says there is a need for a systematic approach to educate communities to safeguard the dignity of such individuals.
They tend to overprotect family members with disabilities, thinking that they cannot go to school. As they interact with other non-disabled children, perhaps they face the risk of being stigmatized, being harmed, and that will tend to affect them psychologically. So you find that they are always kept at home. So persons with disabilities or children with disabilities tend to grow up with a negative self-concept.
Mungoni, who is blind, says over the years, blind children have been denied relevant reading materials. He says this is contrary to the Sustainable Development Goals, which call on governments to ensure inclusive and quality education for all citizens.
Some mathematics, you know, is presented in diagrammatic or pictorial representations. Some subjects, science subjects, are presented, you know, pictorially or diagrammatically. Now, given the fact that in Zimbabwe there is an acute shortage of braille reading material, children with visual impairment have to depend on sighted persons who read out to them books in conventional print. So to actually decode something in diagrammatic representation, it's quite challenging.
Mungoni says if independence is to have meaning for people with disabilities, government should put together a ministry for such people, as is the case in Uganda, Botswana, and South Africa. He says this will ensure that all government policies are sensitive to the needs of the disabled. 28-year-old Hedwig Machina, who is disabled in both legs and uses a wheelchair, shares the same views. She says Zimbabweans should respect the constitution, which states that people with disabilities should have access to education.
Most of the schools are not accessible. You find there will be stairs, accessibility to the toilets, accessibility to the offices, whereby maybe you want to go and see your teacher or your lecturer. You won't be able to just go maybe by yourself. You actually need someone to assist you.
Machina says people still discriminate against those with disabilities 30 years after independence. Reporting in Harare, I am Safari Njema.
Elephant crop breeding continues to be a major source of conflict between people and wildlife in Kenya. One researcher is hoping to alleviate the problem by using elephants' natural aversion to bees to deter them from farms. VOA's Jill Craig visited the project before this month's Giants Club Summit, which brings dignitaries together at Mount Kenya to find solutions to combat poaching, the number one threat to elephants.
African elephants are the largest land animals on Earth, weighing as much as 6 tons and measuring up to 7.5 meters long. Despite their size, elephants still find humans to be their greatest threat. Tens of thousands of elephants are killed every year for their ivory tusks. The head of the Human-Elephant Coexistence Program at conservation group Save the Elephants, Dr. Lucy King, says poaching is devastating animal populations across Africa. But another major concern is human-wildlife conflict. When elephants eat crops, it causes financial loss to the farmers and potential harm to the elephants.
The population in Africa is increasing exponentially, and the land space for elephants and other large game is shrinking exponentially. Corridors are being blocked, infrastructure development is coming up, and so I believe the next big challenge for elephants is going to be conflict. And that interface between actual farmers and elephants is the one that we're working on, and we feel we can do something with.
King learned that when elephants hear this sound, they round up their herd and move away quickly. So the Elephants and Bees Project was born. King and her team work near Kenya's Tsavo East National Park, where they help 22 farmers build and maintain beehive fences, which consist of between 10 and 21 hives, depending on the size of the farmer's plot. The hives are strung along the periphery of the farmer's crops to deter the elephants from crop raiding. The team monitors each farmer's hives carefully, taking notes on each one and also working with the farmers to determine the elephants' movements in the area. Local farmer Charity Mwangome, who built her fence in 2012, believes all the buzz. She says it helps a lot because if the elephants come in and they see the fence, they stop and do not come into the farm. They instead go around. But the beehive fence, which King says has about an 80% success rate, does not just help keep out the elephants. It also provides farmers with another means of income, through honey production. And for farmers who are on average making $300 per year, less than a dollar a day, the 30 to 50% income boost makes a big difference. Elephants and Bees Project Research Center Coordinator Matthew Rudolph says the biggest problem is just keeping up with consumer demand for the honey, which he and other staff members process.
People pick it up as soon as it is jarred.
Which promises a sweeter future for farmer and elephant alike. Jill Craig, VOA News, Voi, Kenya.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with athletics. Kenyan world half marathon champion Peres Jepchirchir prevailed in a time of 1 hour 7 minutes and 21 seconds at the Yangzhou Jiangzhen half marathon in China on Sunday. She improves the women's course record by 55 seconds. Ethiopian runner-up Birhanu Dibaba Adugna and third-placed Kenyan Pascalia Chepkorir Kipkoech were also faster than the previous course record of 1 hour 8 minutes and 16 seconds. Meanwhile, Ethiopian defending champion Mosinet Germeu triumphed in the men's race in a time of 1 hour and 43 seconds. Kenyan Edwin Kipyego, then Ethiopian Feyisa Lelisa followed across the finish line. In Turkey, Viola Jepchumba clocked 1 hour 8 minutes and 18 seconds to carry the day in the women's race at the Istanbul Half Marathon on Sunday. Ethiopians Meskerem Assefa and Amane Gobena placed second and third respectively. Meanwhile, Eritrean world record holder Zerzene Tadesa was runner-up in the men's race ahead of Kenyan Leonard Lagat. In Morocco, Atef Saad won the Agadir International Marathon in 2 hours 13 minutes and 51 seconds to become the first Tunisian to qualify for the marathon race at the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Kenyans Douglas Chebi, then Anthony Wairuru, followed across the finish line. Meanwhile, Uganda is well on their way to hosting a successful 2017 IAAF World Cross Country Championships. The IAAF technical delegate Carlos Cardoso told the media in Kampala, Uganda on Monday. Cardoso made the remarks at the conclusion of an inspection tour of facilities designated for the event. Over 700 athletes from more than 70 countries are expected to converge in the Ugandan capital on the 26th of March next year for the event. Finally, in rugby, Spain beat Namibia 40-22 as Uruguay outclassed Zimbabwe 50-22 at the World Rugby Under-20 Trophy in Harare, Zimbabwe on Saturday. And that's it for Daybreak African Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. A military general in Burundi has been shot dead while dropping his daughter off at school as the International Criminal Court announced it will examine outbreaks of violence in the troubled country. General Athanasi Kararuza, an advisor to Burundi's vice president, was killed along with his wife and one of his bodyguards in the capital Bujumbura on Monday. A military official said Kararuza's daughter was injured in the attack, which took place outside of her school. Monday's attack came on the same day that the International Criminal Court announced it will examine reports of killings, torture, rapes, and other crimes stemming from the political turmoil in Burundi over the past year. And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Madu discusses World Immunization Week, the progress made on the vaccine front, and the remaining challenges. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Let's chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.